You ever heard of Roger Williams? You can see when he lived, 1603, 1683. Roger Williams was a minister, and he lived in the Massachusetts Bay Colony shortly after it was established. And Williams, while living in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, that colony was what we would call Anglican. The Church of England was the dominant religion. It was the state religion. And while living in the colony there, Williams became convinced that the Bible taught believers baptism and some Baptist principles. And so Williams was so convinced of this that he began teaching this to people. And of course, the clergy in the Massachusetts Bay Colony didn't like what he had to say and actually excommunicated him from the church, which meant that he was also kicked out of the colony. He had to go live somewhere else. And so he fled the colony really under threat of arrest. He established his home just south of Plymouth, but it was soon discovered that that's where he was hiding out, and so the authorities went to seek him again in that place, and he was again pushed away, and he eventually moved across the Seekonk River to get away from the authorities. And it was there that he decided to settle down, and he purchased a little piece of land from the Massasoit Indian tribe. And after he purchased that piece of property, it became a haven for him to settle in and others who were fleeing the colony for the same kind of religious reasons. And do you know what he named that little piece of property? Providence. And today we know it as Providence, Rhode Island. It was established in 1636. And the whole establishment of that colony, as it were, Williams called it that because he said, God providentially put me here. Now you think of all that he went through, coming to his own convictions, of Baptist convictions. You think of his own persecution, being chased out of his home, being driven out of other places. And he attributes all those things to the hand of God. And he said, this was God's providence that put me here. So, with that introduction, I want to speak the next several Lord's Day evenings again on this idea of God's providence. What is God's providence? How do you know what God's providence is? Have you seen it in your life? What's the evidence of it? Well, in the 17th, 18th, and early 19th centuries, people spoke rather freely about God's providence. If you go back and you read from that time and that era, people regularly speak of God's providentially doing this, and this was God's hand, and they would use that kind of language. And that was just a regular occurrence. Even quote-unquote unbelievers or people who believed in God but didn't necessarily have a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. But today, that word providence has fallen out of usage. I mean, when's the last time you read it in an article that wasn't a religious article, right? When's the last time you even heard that kind of term being thrown around? Even though today, on our planet, still the vast majority of people believe in some kind of God, still there's not always this discussion about a God who is actively involved in every detail of life, that he has a providence about him. Why not? Well, because the modern day in which we live, people oftentimes now don't think of things in terms of God's working things together providentially, but oftentimes they think, well, we have come to the point where we've evolved and grown enough more information to now we've come to the place that we have science that explains a lot of things. So the thinking would go before when people would attribute things to God's providence or certain things happening, storms and that kind of thing. We now know how all of that happens. We've learned more about that, and this is just the natural cause of nature and the laws of nature. And so it was a century ago that this little poem would be well known and understood, right? Behind the bread is the snowy flower, and behind the flour, the mill, and behind the mill, the grain and the shower, and behind the shower is God's will. Well, how would this poem be read today? You'd probably substitute the last line with this. Behind the shower is the hydrological cycle. Right? It's evaporation, and I'm going to get myself in trouble. I didn't check with my scientist. Condensation, then rain, that kind of thing, that cycle, okay? Because people say, well, that's science, right? We just know how that works now. And so science has focused attention on the immediate activity of cause and effect. But still, if you keep going back, you say, well, what's behind the hydrological cycle? What's behind the stability of even the molecules that make it possible for condensation and all of that? And so while the world today, by and large, has said, well, we really don't need God. In fact, we can explain a lot of what happens today just in terms of natural law and natural causes. I think there, if you focus on the immediate causal thing, perhaps you can explain that scientifically, but there's still the big picture that has to be explained. Okay? Does that make sense? So what I want to do tonight is just kind of dip our toes into this topic and talking about divine providence. We're going to go over successive weeks. We'll talk about one aspect of God's providence tonight, another one, Lord willing, next Sunday night, and then the third Sunday night we'll wrap this up. But I want to begin with a definition of God's providence. How would you define this? Well, let me just break down the term for you. The term providence is a Latin word, and it's made up of two words that kind of helps me to understand what it means. The first word, obviously, is pro, which means before or in front of. The last is the Latin word videre, which is to see. We get our English word video from this, so maybe that will help you. And so just the term itself, if you take it at face value, it means to see before or in front of. All right, so if we're saying, we're talking about God's providence or God's seeing before or in front of, are we simply talking about God's omniscience, that he knows everything? And here we need to make a distinction. Providence has to do with God's omniscience, but the two are not the same. And we're going to see that in just a minute. So don't think in terms of, oh, I know what providence is. It means that God just knows everything. But this is a specific kind of knowing beforehand, because when we look at it from a biblical perspective, it carries more information than that. In fact, if you're going to look up the term providence in your Bible, you go to your concordance and you look up the term providence, how many times are you going to find it? Well, I'll tell you. You'll only find it once, and that's only in certain English versions of the Bible. Okay? So let me take you to that one place, and maybe you're holding a Bible and it actually uses the word. And if not, I'll point it out to you what it is in our English Standard Version. Look at Acts 24. Acts 24 and verse 2. And just in the context, Paul is before this Roman official, and there's also this lawyer named Tertullus, and Paul's going to argue his case, but this guy named Tertullus is arguing against Paul. And what Tertullus is going to do before Felix, this official, is he's going to kind of flatter him and butter him up a little bit before he actually gets into his argument. And that's what's going on here in verse 1 of Acts 24. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. They laid before the governor their case against Paul. Verse 2. And when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, Since through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. And blah, blah, blah. He goes on and just flatters this guy. You see in the ESV the term foresight, since by your foresight, most excellent Felix. Okay, that word is translated as providence in the King James Version and in the New American Standard Version. And it really does carry an accurate idea of that. He's saying reforms have been made in the nation. And you, Felix, it's not just that you saw this coming. It's that you have actually put in place things to make it come about. So it's the idea of not just knowing beforehand, but it includes the idea of making provision for that to happen. Do you see that? So providence occurs here. Maybe this will help. Look at Romans 13. And here's this idea of providence expressed in Romans 13 and verse 14, where we read Paul saying, "But put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh." There's the term translated foresight or providence back in Acts 24, this term provision for the flesh. And what this verse is saying is, again, it includes more than just looking ahead and seeing. It's talking about provisional thinking. It's saying, you know your fallenness, and don't make provision or looking ahead and finding ways to fulfill your fallenness. Don't make provision for that flesh. Don't look ahead and look to bring that about in these particular ways. And this is the idea of providence. This is where it differs from omniscience. Omniscience is God knows everything. Providence is God is actually seeing beforehand and putting things into practice to make something come about. And that's providence. The idea of providence is found in multiple places in the Bible. For instance, look at Genesis 22. Genesis 22, God has given Abraham and Sarah a son, the promised son from Sarah when she was old. And of all things, God asks Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac. And so Abraham obeys, and he takes Isaac, and they're going to go up to the mountain. And as they're going, Isaac notices that there's wood for the fire, there's the flint for the fire, there's a knife, but he says, "Where's the sacrifice?" There is no sacrifice. And notice what Abraham says to him in verse 8 of Genesis 22. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on his son Isaac, and Isaac took in his hand the fire and the knife, so they went both of them together. Verse 6, verse 7, Isaac said to his father Abraham, "My father," he said, "here am I, my son." He said, "Behold the fire, the wood, where's the lamb for a burnt offering?" Verse 8, Abraham said, "God will provide for himself a lamb for the burnt offering." Now, that's the word you've probably heard, Jehovah Jireh, as it's commonly stated. But what Abraham is saying is, God knows the situation. God's going to provide the offering. God has seen what we need, and he will make provision. The same kind of thing is mentioned in verse 14. And so Abraham's not just saying God knows everything. He's saying God's actually active, and he's going to bring it about. He will provide the offering that's necessary. This idea of providence is found all over the book of Esther. When's the last time you read the book of Esther? The name of God is never mentioned in the book of Esther. But God's fingerprints are all over that book. God made provision for Esther to be in the king's palace at the right time. He made provision for her to throw a party right when Haman would come to accuse the Jews. I mean, you read all of that, and it's just God had seen all of these things before, and it's like God is bringing them together. He's working out these circumstances in a perfect way. And it's just a testimony to God's providence. So what is God's providence? How could we define it? Here's the passages for you. Genesis 22, the book of Esther. Here's a definition. It's not mine. It comes from Wayne Grudem in his Systematic Theology. And Grudem says this: God's providence is his continual involvement with all created things in such a way that he does three things. He keeps them existing and maintaining the properties with which he created them. Two, he cooperates with created things in every action, directing their distinctive properties to cause them to act as they do. And finally, he directs them to fulfill his purposes. Now, that's a mouthful, I know. But it's those three things we're going to unpack over the next three Sunday evenings. Okay? And at the end of this, we're going to say, well, what does this have to do with us? And we'll draw out some application from these things. All right? So this is divine providence. I will break those down more for you in just a minute. But one thing I want to do is to make a distinction here. Okay, he just said we're talking about God's providence in working with individual things. He directs them to fulfill his purposes. It's God intervening in the life of his creation. Is providence different from miracles? Miracles is God intervening in his creation. Is there a difference between the two? And I would say yes. Miracles is God intervening in his creation outside of ordinary means and ordinary ways. The waters of the Red Sea don't just part on their own in an ordinary way on some occasion. When God intervened and he parted those waters, that's a miracle. He's stepping in and using extraordinary means to intervene in the lives of his people or in creation in some way. Providence is ordinary things that don't defy the laws of nature, but God is still working within those natural means to bring about the best end of things. That's God's providence. So there is a distinction there, and I think I have that for you. It's distinct from divine miracles. Miracles are God's use of supernatural means to bring about his will. Providence is God's use of normal means to bring about his will. Just wanted to make that quick distinction. So let's go back to these areas of providence. Grudem said there are three areas of God's providence. And under the general category, we have three topics, right? One area of God's providence is preservation. God keeps all things existing and maintaining their properties with which he created them. That's a part of God's providence. He's holding all things together. Two, there's something called concurrence. And here's what that is. It means that God cooperates with created things in every action, directing their distinctive properties to act as they do. We'll talk about that next week, Lord willing. Finally, the third, we're talking about government, that God directs all things for his purposes. This is a part of providence. There's no accidents. He's directing everything after the counsel of his own will. So tonight, let's talk about preservation, okay? God's providential preservation. What is this? God keeps all things existing and maintaining the properties with which he created them. And let me tell you this. You may not be thinking of this right now, but you are very, very glad that he does. Because if he didn't, you might suddenly fall through that chair you're sitting on. Okay? God keeps things maintaining their properties that they have. Okay? How do we know this? I mean, am I just making this up? Well, let's look at some biblical information. You don't have to turn to these passages. You're welcome to. I have them on the screen for you tonight, and we're just going to look at some verses and see what they teach us about this idea of God's providential preservation of things. First of these, Hebrews chapter 1 and verse 3, it speaks of Jesus, and it says this, Jesus, he is the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. Okay, what is it referring to when it says Jesus upholds the universe by the word of his power? How does he do that? Well, the word beneath that, the Greek word is the word pharaoh, and it means to literally to bear up or to bring something, to carry something. Let me show you how else that word is translated. In 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 13, Paul tells Timothy, when you come, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas, also the books and above all the parchments. And here's a very ordinary use of this word, and he says, Timothy, when you come, don't forget to pick up my cloak and grab my books and carry them to me. And that's the same word that's used in Hebrews 1:3 when it talks about Jesus upholding everything. He's upholding the universe. He's carrying it, as it were. This word is also used in the book of Luke in chapter 5. It says, "Behold, some men were bringing on a bed a man who was paralyzed, and they were seeking to bring him in and lay him before Jesus." Again, this man is carried along by these other men. They are directing his activity, certainly. They are holding him up and bearing him up. And so you can see the sense of this word in the biblical information that tells us that these people have active personal control over something or someone when they're carrying or bearing it. And so in Hebrews 1:3, when it talks about Jesus, it says he has active personal involvement in holding together the universe so it doesn't fly apart. And by the way, for all you English nerds, in Hebrews 1:3, that's a present participle, so it's saying he's doing this right now and he keeps doing it. This is continuous activity. Well, here's another verse. Look at Colossians chapter 1 and verse 17, speaking of Jesus. "He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." He holds everything in its place, the Bible tells us. Look at this passage, Nehemiah chapter 9 and verse 6. "You are the Lord, you alone. You've made the heavens and the heaven of heavens with all their hosts, the earth and all that is on it, the seas and all that is in them. And you preserve all of them, and the hosts of heaven worship you." You can see in Nehemiah 9:6, there's two aspects of God. There's his creation in the first part. He created all things, and he preserves. He maintains all things. He holds them. He keeps them together. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7 teaches us this as well. Peter writes and he says, "But by the same word," and he's talking about the word of God that created the world, "by the same word, the heavens and earth that now exist are stored up for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the ungodly." Let me ask you, who's keeping things until the day of destruction? God is. Jesus is. He's holding it until the day comes when perhaps he'll let it go and there will be new creation or reforming of creation. Okay, so that's just biblical information. There are a lot of other places that we can go, but the Bible in many places talk about God preserving his world. Okay, so here's what we're going to do now. Here's a providential quiz. Okay, we're going to take a quiz. And answer me. You don't need to answer out loud. If God ceased to exist, God ceased to exist tonight, creation would A, slowly run down to a halt, B, immediately cease to exist, or C, continue to function as is. Okay? What do you think? Anybody say A? No A's. Any C's? Okay, you got the concept, all right? Preservation, God's providential preservation. He holds all things together. The Bible clearly teaches this. If God didn't exist, neither would we. He's the one keeping this whole thing together. Now, I want to move on, and I want to draw some logical conclusions from this. What does this mean? What can we conclude because the Bible teaches that this is true? Number one, we conclude this. Providential preservation denies something called deism. You know what deism is? Deism is often described as watchmaker theology. It's like this. When God created the world, he created it like it was, and it's like he set it ticking and then set it on his shelf and let it go its own way. It's like the watchmaker that makes the watch. He makes sure the watch functions, needs to function, but then he doesn't interact with it anymore. He simply lets it tick away. And quite frankly, most of the founding fathers of our nation kind of held this view that God was a deist. There is a God, he exists, but he's not really involved in my life. He kind of set things in motion, and then he stood back and he's letting it wind down, as it were. Think of it in terms of a drill, right? An automatic drill. Maybe you have a drill, and sometimes there's a function on that drill where you can lock it down, and that drill, it will drill by itself, right? I can set the lock on the trigger, and it's going to drill by itself, and I can push it into something and drill it. That's kind of deism. Set it, let it go. There's also the drill that you have that you got to push the trigger, right? And so you're active in how and way the way that thing is drilling, and you are increasing or decreasing the speed, and you're adjusting all of that. Okay, providence is like that. God is not someone that just set it up and let it go. He's actively involved in the things of your everyday life. Those things are every much as bit under his control, as it were, and his oversight. Now, this does not exclude the fact that God uses means. Like we use a drill, right? And we take the drill and we're using the drill to do certain things. It's a means that we use to accomplish something. And it doesn't mean that God directly intervenes all the time. Sometimes he uses the means at his disposal, the ordinary means of things to accomplish his purposes. And this is God's provision, God's providential preservation, rather. The other thing I want to say about this, and maybe you hadn't thought about this, I'll just mention it if you come across it perhaps, it's that providential preservation is not a continuous new creation. And basically, this is kind of a philosophical idea, so I'll be brief, but it's the idea that reality really does exist. Some people say, well, reality is just the mind of God, and God imagined all of the earth, and so every single nanosecond, God is reimagining again, and he's creating everything this way. It's a continuous thought process for God to continually bring new reality at such an instance that we can't even discern that it wasn't there before. And it's kind of a philosophical idea that reality isn't reality. It's just kind of what God thinks in the terms that he's always creating things new. I could explain it best this way. If a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make any noise? Yes. Why? God made the tree. God made the earth. God made sound waves. You don't have to be there to make it happen. It happens. But God providentially knew that tree was going to fall. Makes sense? Not read about new creation or continual preservation and new creation. You'll get it. Okay? So, I want to end tonight with this. What are some practical implications of this? We've seen what the Bible says. God preserves the world. He holds it together. Logical conclusions. He's not just an outside spectator. He's intricately involved in our lives. What can we take away from this? Well, look at Job 34. Job 34. And look at verse 13, okay? This is Elihu, one of Job's friends, and he's talking to him. And it's not that these guys never said anything that was true. It's the fact that they were drawing conclusions that weren't accurate. But here's what he says, Job 34. Look at verse 14. He's speaking of God. And he says, if God should set his heart to it, and gather to himself his spirit and his breath, all flesh would perish together and man would return to dust. So what is Elihu's understanding of the extent of God's providence? It extends to our very what? Breath. Right? But the only reason you can is because of God's providence. And if God chooses to take that breath, that too is under God's control. We read this tonight in the 104th Psalm. Maybe you picked up on it. Look at Psalm 104. In speaking of the creatures of the fields, birds in the trees, look at verse 29. Psalm 104, 29. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. Who determines when they're dying? It's God taking away their breath. So we could say this, providential preservation extends to each breath that we take. God is that much involved in your life that he oversees that. Even that's not out of his control, right? So that's very, very intricate and very detailed. That's why we sing what Watts wrote, and I love singing it. Whenever we sing, I sing the mighty power of God, and he has a line in there. He says, "For all that borrows life from thee is ever in thy care. All that is dependent upon you for life is ever being cared for." And that's true. That's a great biblical line to sing. So providential preservation extends to each breath that we take. It's even that detailed. Second implication. Oh, I'm sorry. I had the verses on there for you. I forgot. Second implication is this. Providential preservation causes all things to maintain their properties until acted upon by some other part of creation. Why is that important? Here's what we're saying. Water has certain properties, and it acts like water. And you're very, very glad for that when you're in a boat on a lake. Because what if you're traveling in a boat on a lake on the water and suddenly that water, its properties change and it acts like granite? What happens to your boat? Right? What happens to your movement? Okay, the fact that God holds all things together and maintains the properties of everything that he has created means that there's stability. Stability in those properties. Rock acts like rock. And when you're rock climbing on a cliff face, if you do that kind of thing, you're glad it does. And it doesn't suddenly decide to act like water, or you're in real trouble, right? Light acts like light. These things that have their properties, when we observe these things scientifically, we call them laws of nature. And the reason we call them laws is because they are consistent in maintaining their properties over certain spans. And notice I said until acted upon by some other part of creation, right? You can melt things down and change its properties. But in general, things are stable. And because that is true, you know what we can do? We can do science. Do you like science? It's an amazing thing to be able to understand all the intricacies of God's world and look at it through science. But the reason we can do science and draw conclusions and those kinds of things is because properties are primarily stable. And God holds those things together. If he didn't, we would all be in trouble. God maintains a universe that acts in predictable ways. And because that is the case, research is possible. And we can research, we can know how things are going to react, and therefore, we can build technology. You can build a superconductor. How? Because you know how things are commonly going to react under certain conditions, and you can test it, and you can build things to help it react in certain ways, and this is all a part of technology and development and growth. You know what? Here's what it's saying. You and I can fulfill the dominion mandate. Have dominion over the earth. Bring about good things from the earth. Why? Because God maintains the stability of its properties. Because God is holding things together, and they act in responsible and in predictable ways. And therefore, we can do what God has called us to do. Aren't you thankful for that? So, providential preservation causes all things to maintain their properties until acted upon by some other part of creation. But finally, I want you to note this. Providential preservation is cause for thankfulness and worship. So I'm thankful for God's preservation and I should worship Him. How does that work? Tonight, before church, car was running on fumes. And so I had to go down here to the, I think it's a Shell station now, and get gas down here. Pay way more than I wanted to, right? But it was close, so I went down to the station. And I pull out the gas pump, and I stick it in my tank, and there's a couple other people there at the gas station. I don't know who they are. I'm assuming they're not believers. Maybe I shouldn't. They might be believers. But I'm sitting there, and I'm pumping gas in my car, and I'm thinking, you know what? God maintained the properties of this fuel that I'm putting in my car. So that when I put it in there and it comes into the engine and there's spark, and that spark ignites the fire that blows up basically in the engine block that pushes the piston down and turns the crank and generates, you know, energy to the wheels and transfers that through a transmission so that it moves, that the only reason that all of this works together is because God is holding it together in the first place. And I'm having a moment of worship at the gas pump. I'm really thinking about all that. I'm thinking, that's amazing. We can dig this stuff out of the earth and refine it, and it works this way, and we figured out how to put it into motion. And I'm looking across at these other people there at the gas pump. Again, I don't know them. But I'm thinking, if they don't know the Lord, they're not having that experience. They can say, oh yeah, I know how an internal combustion engine works, four-stroke engine, four-stroke cycle, all that, intake, compression, all that. But they're not saying, but the only reason it works that way is because God holds it together and He has made stability in all of these properties that we can take and use and create things with. So this week, as you go about your week, think about that. The only reason I can drive my car to work is because God preserves and holds everything together, and He's made it work in such a way that we can research it, we can know how to make it, and how to make it work. And by the way, God works with electric engines too, okay? But do you see that? When that hits your mind, it's a whole different understanding of how this world works and who's really in charge of it. So worship God. Worship Him for His wisdom and preservation. Just this in conclusion. Here's some questions for personal reflection this week, right? When talking about the providence of God, if God is in control of all things, how often do you refer to luck or chance in casual conversation? There are times when you talk about being lucky, or hopefully by chance this will happen. I know we slip in that. I don't want to be legalistic about that. But just think, is that kind of something we slip into? Does anything really happen by chance? How about this? Are phrases like good luck or cynical references to Murphy's Law, though innocent, really consistent with the Bible's teaching on providence? They're not. And again, I don't want to be stickler about this, but just think about that. What am I really making reference to? And finally, if the Bible really does teach God's providence over all things, what should your attitude be toward the things you're presently experiencing? How should you view those things? Will you view them differently, knowing they come from God? What difference would that make? And we'll really get into that next week when we talk about concurrence and how God works with the things that He has made to bring about His will. Okay? All right. Let's pray, and we'll close this part of our service tonight. All right?